listener production.
I was feeling good until I thought I should get out of the car now. I reached over for the door handle and my fingers weren't working anymore. And then I put my hand back down on my leg and I just couldn't feel my legs. It was the worst moment of my life.
Sounds frightening, doesn't it? But it is, when we peel this story back, one of the most important factors to consider when we get behind the wheel. We're talking about the conditions. It affects all sorts of things, from stopping distances to car behaviour. And because we get cocooned and often surrounded by modern tech designed to keep us safe, that heightened sense of awareness that we need when the weather isn't perfect is something we can become blasé about. Busy lives can leave us focused on making the deadline rather than being present and driving accordingly. Hi, everybody. I'm Rusty.
And I'm Lisa.
Welcome to Keep Your Wheels On, the podcast where you'll hear from real people talking about the mistakes that either resulted in them crashing their car or narrowly avoiding a situation that could have been much worse. And along the way, we'll also talk to and be joined by some experts to chat about how you can do your best to avoid ending up in a similar situation. Lisa, the work you do around My Drive School, helping our young drivers, how important is the subject of weather? It can sound boring, right? Conditions, when we say it like that, but giving them exposure to this is vital, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's really why we do what we do. We simulate all sorts of different situations and scenarios and actually let people learn to drive to conditions and let them actually understand firsthand in a safe and controlled environment how it's different. Different surfaces, different weather, different traffic, different roads, all manner of things we can actually simulate in a safe and controlled environment.
Now, our expert today is someone that both Lisa and I have crossed paths with many times over the years. He has channeled his energies into driver training and, like Lisa, could see places that needed serious attention in properly equipping people for the road and its dangers. Now, you might have seen him on the news championing Fatality-Free Friday, a great success story in its own right that is supported by lots of celebrities and more endeavouring to get the message out there around safe driving. Russell White, CEO of the Australian Road Safety Foundation, is with us. G'day and thank you for coming on.
Oh, Rusty, great to be with you. And Lisa, great to help you as part of this innovation. I think the work that you're doing in this space is really invaluable. And I think, you know, these podcasts, I think, are a great way of getting the broader picture out to the broader community. So great to be with you. And as I said, Lisa, congratulations on getting this podcast together.
Thanks, Russell.
What can we expect as we break this story down? As you'll hear, Russell, our guest takes us through a very difficult set of circumstances that happened to them. The overarching theme of today is conditions. In what you've done over more than two decades in this business, how important is that in messaging to people and learning to be ready for that?
Rusty, I think it's actually, it's mission critical in my opinion. I think what we often do as part of the licensing process is we teach people the fundamental things. And the example I use is like with school. At preschool level, there's certain things you teach kids at that level. And then when they get to, you know, year 7, year 8, year 9, to year 12, there's other things they learn along that journey. And I think what we expect from drivers is we give them preschool level education. So, you know, the black and white stuff, the this means go, this means stop, give way here. And we spend a lot of time looking at that regulation, but we sort of expect them to perform at year 12 or university level or beyond with no education in between. And I think one of the great gaps in the market is that there is no next step, or it's emerging, I should say, obviously through the sort of the training programs that we're going to cover today. But I think, you know, we need to get more people to understand that your driving is governed by two things, and that's level of grip and level of visibility. And if either of those two things are compromised in any way, then the driver has to make an adjustment for that. And then when you combine the dynamics on top of all that, and I think just about every person listening to this podcast can probably list an example or can think of an experience where they've been caught by surprise, where those things where the grip hasn't been great and they haven't adjusted to that. And I still always remember the words of my mentor, the legendary Frank Gardner, Frank used to say, you know, there is no such thing as a dangerous car, a dangerous set of conditions, or a dangerous road. It's what the driver makes it. And I've kind of always resonated with that statement because I thought it's really true. Like, vehicles mightn't be ideal, but that's the driver's responsibility to get it fixed and sorted out. The roads we can't change, or the weather conditions we can't change, but ultimately we've got to try and adapt to suit those conditions. And it's no different, as you know, in any form of vehicle transport, all the way through to motorsport. If grip and vision are compromised, or one of those things are compromised, the driver's got to make an adjustment for that. And I think, you know, the time's come now, well and truly, in our, with our current road safety performance and the numbers of people that are being killed and injured on our roads, that the time's come to look at some of these human factors that ultimately we as, and I'll say drivers, but ultimately it's a cyclist, it's a motorbike rider, it's everybody, we've all got that ability to simply just roll out of it. And a lot of the times, just lifting off the throttle is enough to fix a lot of this stuff.
Beautifully said.
In the last 50 years, every aspect of road safety has been changed and modified, except for the way we actually teach people how to drive. Still, it's just a matter of somebody sitting in the passenger seat telling that person in the driver's seat what to do. When they're not there anymore, they crash.
Yep.
But if you look at all the other aspects of road safety, you've got, you know, cars. These days, very, very safe, you know, safe as houses. Our roads are a whole lot better than what they used to be. And our medical intervention is amazing. But the one remaining factor is still that human element. So it's actually about skill, education, and attitudes.
Why don't we circle back to the story of today and let's hear a bit more about it. Let's meet the person behind the story.
Hi, my name is Dinesh Palapanam. I had a car accident in my 20s in the wet weather that changed my life forever. Ever since I was a kid, I've really loved cars. I actually took a flying lesson before I took my first driving lesson. So just things with an engine, something that's close to my heart. I learned to drive in my mum's car. Mum was great. You know, my mum has taught me how to do so many things in my life. She's taught me how to shave. She's taught me how to drive. She's taught me how to open a bank account. So many things in my life has been thanks to my mum. I also went to a driving school because I think that's really important. I was very precise with my driving. I took the defensive driving courses and learned a bit more about the vehicle, how it handles and what to do with it. But I've learned in life never to consider myself good at anything. And that's not, you know, that's not a self-flagellating thing or anything, but I think life actually has to be about getting better at things and trying to do things better. And I think once we learn to understand that and embrace that, life becomes richer every day. And I think I was the same with driving. I always thought that I had more to learn and to get better. I was 25 years old when I had the car accident. I was a medical student then. I loved playing basketball. I was living by myself in this beautiful apartment in Gold Coast. Loved just being outdoors. I just loved life. I think I was on top of the world. It was 31st of January 2010 when I had the accident, and it was the latter part of summer. And there were a lot of storms then. It was one of those days where it just rained off and on and the sun poked out every now and again, but mostly it was wet. I wasn't really that concerned about the conditions. It was a pretty standard day. It wasn't anything crazy when it comes to the weather. I left the house at 8:30 p.m. that night. It was dark. It wasn't storming. It wasn't raining heavily, but it was raining lightly off and on. I was in a 2004 Nissan X-Trail at the time. It was in really good condition and had all-wheel drive. So it felt like a safe car. And it felt quite boring and normal that night, the drive. You never think about it, right? When you need to go to a place in a car, you just jump in the car and drive off. And sure, sometimes like the weather is so bad that you have no visibility and you might need to pull over, but it's so rare to be in that situation. But that was a day when I just didn't think twice.
Let's just break this down a little bit. Firstly, Russell, to you, how common are crashes in what Dinesh has described there, which don't sound like, you know, fierce howling winds, a wild storm as such? We fundamentally would describe that as normal weather, wouldn't we?
Yeah, it's part of the normal weather envelope that you've got to deal with as a driver. Just, you know, there'll be sunny days, there'll be foggy days, there'll be rainy days, there'll be night. The list can go on. But what tends to happen, I think, is because we drive every day and because nothing bad happened yesterday or the day before, or the day before that, you tend to get lulled into this false sense of security that that's going to be the situation every day. And, you know, I think even in Dinesh's description there, it wasn't anything extra out of the ordinary, but conditions had altered and the wet is around. A few things happen. One is the grip levels can change very, very quickly. At an intersection where there's oil and dust and lubricant, everything, there's all these sort of this cocktail of things that get dumped at intersections or roundabouts for that matter. And I've seen crashes where people have come around a roundabout. In fact, I witnessed one. I was following two little old ladies that live in our area. They've come around the roundabout exactly the same way as they've always done. And then they just happen to find the car suddenly spinning out and they lose control, spin. Fortunately, they don't hit anything. And so they get a bit of a shock. But the lady said to me when I got to her, she said, oh, but I drive that roundabout every day and it's never been a problem before. But from what I know as a trainer, she's probably developed the habit of just ever so slightly cracking the throttle open or starting to increase acceleration while she's still got the steering lock on going around the roundabout. Mm. And so got away with it when the grip's good. But when the grip's not good, all of a sudden, you know, that's when the rears break loose and they spin. So it doesn't have to be, as you said just before, it doesn't have to be, you know, cyclonic conditions. It can just be a shower of rain that just happens to have, you know, come out of the afternoon. And especially even in those first bits of rain, people are very rarely connected to the car. So when it starts to lose control, they're almost in too deep. It's already well underway. Whereas if you're connected to the car, if you're trained properly, you get a subtle sense that the car talks to you all the time. Mm. And if you're connected to it, a little bit like a racing driver, I mean, it's a slightly different thing because it's a road car, but if you've got a connection to it, by the seat of your pants, you get this sixth sense that, oh, the car just went a bit light there. And if you can lift off at that moment rather than waiting to, oh, dear, I'm actually sideways now, It's a millisecond thing, but it's about developing a sense of mechanical sympathy and a connection to the car that helps you to feel the dynamics of it all.
I want to come back to that, the car talking to you. I reckon that's important. Lisa, to you, Russell mentioned the word habit there before, right, which I think is another really good point. Why do you think people sort of dismiss weather as a bit of a danger in safe driving? Is it because of what I said at the top about the normalisation, the fact that we're in a hurry to get to work, the fact that we've got a deadline to meet and so on, that we don't pause to think about the dangers in those change conditions?
When you're doing the same route every day, you get very complacent with that. So, you know, people are just driving, you know, day to day, you know, they're running late, they're doing this. But the main thing is, so many people aren't actually taught properly in the first place to actually understand the dynamics around how it can change and what it feels like to change and when to have that lift off if something's going to happen. Mm. You know, that's what's important. You know, when kids are doing their learners, when it's raining, that's the time that you need to get them out to actually let them understand some of those behaviours of the car and or how much longer it takes them to stop or all sorts of different scenarios as opposed to just the same constant. Because driving every day isn't a constant.
No.
I mean, it is for people. They obviously do it every day, but there's changing conditions all the time.
To both of you, I think a little note for parents who are perhaps listening with their kids here at the moment, this just reinforces what you both are very passionate about, and that is the benefit of proper, practical, advanced driver training. Now, Russell, before we go back to Dinesh, how, in simple terms, for those that may not be aware of it, does a wet road react differently to a dry road? And do you have to be going fast to be impacted by those changes?
Yeah, great question, Rusty. And I think the thing that people need to remember is that if it never rained on our roads, we could have a slick tyre like they have in motorsport. But just like in motor racing, if you're caught on slick tyres and it's wet, you're going to slide off the road very quickly. And sometimes that can be at walking pace. It doesn't have to be going very fast. So water acts as a lubricant to rubber in the sense that it develops a film between the road, the asphalt, the rubber, and the gap that is sandwiched between the two. That's where that term aquaplaning comes from. Your normal tyre at 100K an hour down a freeway in a, let's say, a shower of rain, is pumping away between 4.5 to 5 litres of water per second. And it's using the tread channels in the tyre and the sipes to sort of drag the water away from the contact patch of the tyre. And I think that's the other thing we've got to remember, you know, we've only ever got a patch about the size of a hand on each corner of the car. So even though there's four tyres underneath us, there's only ever a handprint or thereabouts. And as you go through corners, obviously those handprints lift. And a really good example is if you say you're going through a right-hand bend, it's the two tyres on your left-hand side that are doing the work. The two on the right really aren't doing very much at all. And out of the two on the left, it's left-hand front that's doing the majority of the work to keep the car on the road. So it's understanding the dynamics that are involved. It's also understanding that the tyre grip is compromised the moment there's water on the road. Now, we're blessed, as again, I think you or Lisa said at the start, you know, the tyre technology today is amazing, providing you're looking after your tyres and that they've got plenty of tread on them and you've got them pumped up properly. And that's something you've got to not underestimate the value of that. But I think that the key thing to take away from it is that the water acts as a lubricant to the rubber. The rubber's obviously what's keeping you gripping to the road, and it's the tread channels that if there is water on the road, the volume of that has to be dealt with. And as I said before, at 100K an hour on just a shower can be, you know, those sort of 5 or 6 litres can easily jump to 9 or 10 litres of water per second if it's really in a torrential rain. And that's also why you've got to throttle right back, because your grip's well and truly compromised like that.
Let's head back to Dinesh now. He headed out on wet roads. Let's find out some more about what happened to him on that drive.
When things went wrong, I was probably about halfway into the drive. The speed limit varied between 80 around the roadwork zone to 100. I was driving under the speed limit a little bit just because I remember that because that stretch of road was just a bit dark. Just having roadworks and bits and pieces around, I was driving a little bit under, maybe like 5 to 10Ks under the speed limit. The thing is, there have been times very early on when I first started driving where I have done stupid things and I would have said, okay, if an accident happened then, that would have been entirely my fault. But on this night, it was completely beyond my control. I don't think, apart from to maybe taking another road or being in a different lane or maybe going even slower, I don't think there was anything differently I could have done to avoid that accident. I was driving along perfectly normally. The car was steady. There was no rain at that time. It was perfectly just normal. And then it was dark, right? So I remember coming up to either a water puddle or the other alternative is that it might have been like some oil or something. But I remember seeing this like black puddle-like thing on the road. But it came up so quickly and it was too late to avoid it. And it wasn't huge. It wasn't huge. As soon as my car drove into it, it lost control. I felt like I was driving on a piece of butter, you know, like this big block of butter. There was no traction and the wheels were just, I'd lost control. The car hit it, suddenly started spinning around and around and around and around and around and around. And it was so fast, it was so violent, and I thought, I need to get control of the car back. The car went off the side of the road, went up this embankment and turned around, and then the front of the car came back down and then it smashed onto the highway. So the front of the car comes down the embankment, smashes onto the tarmac, and then the car starts flipping through the air front to back. Now I'm flipping through the air, and it was so violent. The car had a sunroof, so the sunroof shattered. The window shattered because the roof was caving in. Everything was becoming destroyed, and it just flipped and flipped and flipped and flipped and flipped. I was panicking. It was adrenaline. I was trying to just figure out what was happening to start with. It wasn't even like a gradual start. It just happened, and then it just escalated to a point where I was like, I can't believe this is happening right now. It is a miracle that I didn't get hit by anyone else, because I always think if there was a truck or another car close behind, I might have been hit. But also the way the car landed, actually landed on the side of the road outside the line. So, you know, thank God I didn't cause an injury to someone else or another car or a truck didn't hit me, because I would have been cleaned up. It was the craziest, most violent experience of my life.
So a very scary set of circumstances there, with maybe a little silver lining in the sense that it could have been clearly worse. There is a bit to digest in what he's just talked about. At least, can we begin with you driving at night in the dark? Are accidents more likely in the dark of night rather than in you know, the daytime?
I mean, there's a reason why we actually get all learners to actually do X amount of their hours in the dark, because, you know, it is a different environment, and to actually understand, you know, especially cars coming towards them, lights, you know, where to put your eyes, all that stuff. But it's not necessarily the most dangerous time to drive. Probably around the dawn and dusk is very hazardous around regional and remote, especially because you've got all the animals and other hazards that come out. Mm. But annually, we've got about 1,200 people that die on our roads every year. But we've got about 40,000 people that are involved in crashes every year. And of those 40,000, there's about 1,200 per year that end up with lifelong injuries like Dinesh.
So, Russell, how should people, what kind of things should they be doing in terms of handling a car at night in the dark? What are the fundamentals?
Again, as I've said, sort of as we kicked off, you know, at nighttime your vision's compromised. You're dictated to a lot from the sweep or the radius sweep of what the headlights are going to pick up. So it makes driving at night tricky in the sense that you may not get as much warning as you do, obviously, in a dry or a sunny condition, because you can see a little bit further ahead down the road. We tend not to look far enough ahead as drivers anyway. In fact, as a trainer for more than 30 years, I'd have to say the one thing that I've never seen a person sit next to me and do well straight out of the box was use their eyes well enough. And training people to look further ahead down the road, to use your side windows a bit more, to scan around as much as possible. You know, we've only got a really small area of clear focus with our vision. The rest of what we see is peripheral. So the trick is to keep that level of clear focus bouncing around as much as you possibly can. And then I think you've just got to also then be trying to project your mind further ahead, because again, as in this case, something has suddenly appeared in front of the car. And again, I will say, I think based on my experience, most people live in a little world immediately in front of the bonnet, and therefore they don't see something until it's too late, till they've almost run over it or they have run over it. So I think for me, driving at night means projecting your mind even further ahead, increasing your margins as much as you possibly can. And obviously, this is all in addition to just sticking to the basic road rules. For me, it is about perception, and it's see and be seen. You know, making sure that your car's lit up well enough, that there's no, you know, the bulbs aren't broken and that sort of thing. But ultimately, it's the vision that's the key.
Well, come to both of you, because I'm not a trainer, and I want to try and let this be a little bit of a journey of discovery for people that haven't experienced it before. But I want to put my hand up and say I've experienced aquaplaning, right? Whether it be on the road or very limited moments on a racetrack. But it is fundamentally one of the most unnerving feelings you will come across when you're in the car, because the wheels lose their connect effectively with the road. It does not want to turn or stop in the automated way that you want it to. And it will not work until you get to the point where that grip returns. Why is aquaplaning so frightening, and what are the things we need to do in terms of what you've just described about awareness, looking down the road and seeing if there is a change in surface and so on?
A car will slide, and this is, again, the thing that is important, and it won't roll over, it won't tip over until it hits something that's going to make it do that. On a skid pan, you know, we can slide cars all day and they'll never roll over. They'll roll over only when they hit something, so they go over a curb or something to trip it up, or they go down an embankment, which in Dinesh's case is what sounding like the situation was, that the car's left the road, it's gone down some sort of culvert or an embankment, and that started the rolling process. It goes back to what I said before about being connected to the car. The car, you'll have this sense of lightness, milliseconds, or sometimes even a slight vibration in a wheel. The millisecond the grip disappears. Now, if you're trained to feel that, you can lift off, and in order to get the grip back, the lift off might be a couple of mil off the throttle, not very much at all, just a feather. If it's gone further than that, then you've got to come off the power more. You've got to wind on the opposite lock. I mean, this, we're assuming this is an oversteer situation, not a, and for the listeners, that's a situation where the back of the car steps out and starts to want to try and swap ends with the front. If it's understeer, it means it's pushing. The front wheels are not, haven't got the grip anymore. And even though you've turned the wheel, the car sort of plows straight ahead in the direction it was originally going. So the key thing is that you've got to get the grip back as fast as you can. Now, unfortunately, instinct at that moment, and it's probably changed a little bit now with cars with ABS brakes, but certainly, you know, in the earlier days when we had, you know, HQ Holdens and stuff like that didn't have ABS brakes, you know, typically what would happen is that the car would slide, the driver panics, they probably wound on more steering. The car eventually comes to a point, as you said, Rusty, where the tyres will re-grip. But by that stage, they've wound on the front wheels to be pointing the opposite way. So then the car does the full pirouette. And then typically what happens as it's leaving the road, the driver looks for the very thing they want to avoid, the tree, the post. And that's the moment they hit the brakes, and that breaks the arc of the slide, and that's exactly where the car will end up. So where the eyes go, the mind tends to follow. Even a professional racing car driver, if they have a slide catch them by surprise, they will have their hands full to sort it out. And these are people that are operate at a different level to the average road user. So when the average road user, they experience the car not doing what it's done 17 million times before that, it's the startle factor, it's the panic factor. And as I said, once your eyes have locked onto what you want to avoid and you start to brake, you'll literally drive towards that. It's like a magnet. You'll suck yourself to that. And that's why, quite frankly, we often see cars wrapped very neatly around trees and posts, because that's exactly where the driver's been looking.
So what you need to be doing is looking around for where there's space or where there's an option to actually steer it where there's nothing to hit. We always want to train people to not hit stuff.
Now, we're dealing with wet weather here, but the notion of driving in snow, really heavy rain, perhaps even ice in some parts of the country, if we're in colder areas, that's another level again, Russell, isn't it?
You've only got to look at some footage that comes off, and we see it from overseas, you know, North America or Canada. There's so much ice on the road. Cars are just literally sliding down the road, sometimes only at walking pace. But again, there is no grip on the ice. So the driver can do whatever they want with the steering. They can be on the brakes. But that's the other thing I think people need to understand. Brakes don't stop the car. It's the brakes working with the grip of the tyre that actually stops it. And on ice, that's very clear. You know, the wheels can be stopped, but the car continues to slide down the bridge until it hits something. So you're right. Ice driving, snow driving, I mean, there's elements of what we're talking about here, but it's next level again.
Let's get back to Dinesh. Now, his accident is one that had huge consequences for him.
I had no pain once the accident was done. I was a bit stunned. I looked down and I was wearing a white T-shirt. It was red with blood. And I was actually happy that I was alive. It was a moment of relief, actually. I was like, I'm okay. I was feeling good until I thought, I should get out of the car now. I reached over for the door handle with my hand, and my fingers weren't working anymore. And even then I thought, that's a bit weird. And then I put my hand back down on my leg and I just couldn't feel my legs. And then I realized I can't move. I can't move my legs. I can't move my fingers, and I can't feel anything below the chest, and I am paralyzed. I knew. It was so bad. It was, I've never been able to explain what that felt like. I've never been able to explain or put into words that moment, that horror, the choking feeling in my body, my soul. I just never been able to explain what that felt like, but it was... It was the worst moment of my life. The fire truck lost control as well when they were approaching the accident scene. Same spot. They lost control of the truck. It flew past my car, skidding everywhere. but they were able to reverse back. When they came into the car to cut me out, they said it was the first time someone's explained to them that they'd had spinal cord injury because I was a medical student. So they said they were surprised. That night, I was taken into the Princess Alexandra Hospital in Brisbane. I had an operation that night to fixate the spine from the front initially. And then I woke up in the intensive care unit a couple of days later. I had a drain sticking out of my neck. I was initially ventilated. I had all these lines going into me. There were so many things. And when I woke up, it was just a shock. You had to come off the intensive care unit. Then you do the simple things like trying to breathe and trying to sit up without passing out, trying to use your arms and hands again. Then the wheelchair, getting in and out of bed. So it was a very painstaking process after that for about 7 or 8 months in hospital and then another couple of years just for the, I guess, the psychological adaptation and just learning to get around the community. It was so hard at the start and there were days when I cried. There were days when I was just devastated. There were days when things were so difficult. There were dark days. Some days I was just like trying to move my feet, trying to move my toes, just like hoping with all life that it just turns. So it was really hard, you know, it was a mixture of despair and hope. But psychologically, it takes a long time, you know, and I didn't look in a mirror for a long time because looking in a mirror, I suppose, was many things. You know, I think my body had changed. I thought that who I am had changed, even though it hadn't really, in a way. And looking in the mirror was accepting it. It makes it real, yeah. I didn't look in a mirror for probably a couple of years.
We're grateful to Dinesh for sharing this story for all sorts of reasons. This is a frightening story that we hope resonates with our listeners in some respects. You've both, in a training sense, you're about prevention, but this is a reality that an accident of this magnitude can be life-changing.
Nobody goes out with the intent of having a crash. And this stuff happens because, again, something out of the ordinary has happened. Now, what I found really interesting was his comment about the fire truck also losing control. So to me, that suggests there might have been something might have been spilt on the road because, I mean, those things are heavy. It would take a lot for that to lose control. So I tend to think just from that comment that there might have been something else, that maybe there was something spilt on the road or whatever. Mm. It sort of demonstrates just how quickly this whole thing can fall apart very, very fast. And again, maybe through no fault of your own sometimes. You can just arrive there and the scenario is presented in front of you. And I think this is, again, why this whole training piece, you know, is so important because if we look at industries where simulation is done, you know, it's done extensively in the medical world. It's done extensively in aviation. One thing we never do is say to pilots, you know, get them all in a room and just show them photographs of crash planes and say, whatever you do, don't do that.
Absolutely.
There's a whole system that's designed to better train and prepare people for aviation. Sometimes I think people think the scare tactic is the panacea to it all. If we just shock enough people, they'll all wake up. But it won't work with everybody.
Our audience is such, they're all digital natives. They like to learn digitally. That's why simulation and, you know, podcasts or videos or whatever, all those tools work. We don't show kids videos of people drowning before we teach them how to swim. So we want to teach them right back here and positive training as opposed to just scare tactics.
Dinesh hasn't let his accident stop him from his career as a doctor, which is a great thing, but he has definitely faced some challenges along the way.
I'm now 14 years after the injury, which is just wild to think about. I am lucky enough today to be working on a spinal cord injury research project in Queensland at our university. So we're working on therapies to restore function in people with spinal cord injury. And over the next couple of years, we're going to be doing a study on somewhere between 20 to 40 people to hopefully see some exciting results. I have so many perspectives on the changes that have happened after the injury, and initially I would have done anything to have my old life back, anything. But life is very different now, you know, like even getting in and out of a car. You use a slide board, then someone assembles the wheelchair, then we transfer out, you've got to find enough space to make sure that you can do it. And if there's a gutter, you've got to navigate all that. So all of those things take a lot longer than they used to do. Getting in and out of bed, having a shower, wearing clothing that won't cause wounds and injuries, and the temperature even, you know. So you lose the ability to maintain your temperature because the skin doesn't function like it used to. There's the effect on your career and education, even intimacy. So it affects every facet of life. But for me, I've come to still love life because one of the important philosophies in life, I think, is to realize what's in our control and to accept the things that we cannot change and to appreciate what we have. And I still feel like a very lucky person and I'm still grateful for all the things that I have. So I'm still one of the happiest people on this planet. The health professions are so conservative. Over the years, it has become less and less and less. And there are other medical students with disability now and nursing students with disability now. One of the things that a supervisor said to me when I was starting back at medical school is that I don't think the patients would take you seriously. And I always wondered about this. The cool thing is I've seen thousands of patients now. I'm in the 8th year of practice as a doctor. Not a single patient ever has said, "Can you do the job?" And they remind me every day why I'm there. I'm there for the patients. I think the car, the motor vehicle, and when we're driving in it, it does something to our psyche where we feel like we're in this bubble, where we feel invincible, where we feel safe. But I think we have to take stock of this thing that we're actually in, and it's a very dangerous piece of equipment. The way we get our license, I feel, is probably not enough. And I think there needs to be a lot more training to reduce the amount of road trauma. If you have the means and the opportunities to take advanced driving courses or defending driving courses, not just once, but maybe semi-regularly every couple of years, I think it's really useful. But the biggest thing, I think, is just to be psychologically aware of what we're actually doing and to realize that we're not in a bubble that keeps us invincible.
There are some amazing grabs from Dinesh in this podcast. That's arguably one of the strongest ones. Firstly, I have immense admiration for people like him that can be confronted with such a significantly life-changing event and come through with such positivity and to offer us listening to this today all sorts of things to consider when we get behind the wheel next. People need to have that psychology shift he's talking about and reconsider. You are getting into a deadly weapon. You have to make some really good choices with what you're doing.
Road trauma is the number one thing that's going to claim the life of an Australian child aged between 1 and 15. So it's not cancer. It's not drowning in a swimming pool, as terrible as those things are. The number one thing that's likely to claim the life of a child is road trauma. It's second only to youth suicide in the 15 to 24-year-old age bracket. It's the number one thing causing death and injury in the workplace by a long way. And I think we need to reset the narrative around behaviour on the road. You can still be doing something legally, but it doesn't translate automatically to being safe. There's still this risk of, you know, people often say, "Oh, but I wasn't speeding."
Great point.
But might have been going too fast for the conditions, you know. So I think we've got to sort of make people aware that it is the most dangerous thing. If I said to you, "I'm going to get you to handle this high voltage cable every day," first week you might be hypersensitive to it, but the more you got used to it, your risk calibration will drop. Same as the ocean. You might swim every day, but one day you don't see the rip because it wasn't there yesterday or something else has changed. Again, you know, I've driven that road all the time. I know this road like the back of my hand, comments like that. We tend to put in this thing that it's somehow less risky just because we're doing it every day. And the risk is just different. It mightn't be the same every day, but it's going to be different. And there will always be risk there. We should be thinking more, it's not the risk of getting caught doing the wrong thing, it's the risk of what the crash will be.
Statistically, getting in the car every day is the most dangerous thing most people will do every single day. And they don't actually pay it that respect to think of the cause and effect and what could happen with, you know, minor mistakes or lack of consideration or just not being focused enough behind the wheel.
I'm a parent with teenage kids, Russell. It has got to be the best money that you'll spend in terms of trying to equip your kids to understand practical things about how difficult it can be to drive on our roads.
We invest money in music lessons, in tennis coaching, golf lessons. I'm often astounded that people will spend more money on those things that won't kill their child. But I've heard parents say, how few lessons will this take before my child can get a license? And to me, I just think it's just false. It's false economy in thinking because, you know, there is so much to this. And I think that's also, just picking up a point we mentioned before, there's so much in this topic. I mean, I've been doing this for 30 plus years. I still learn. Sometimes it's things that come out of my own mouth, but I still learn a different way. Suddenly the level of understanding, because our level of knowledge improves, we see things at this level that we couldn't ever have seen at that level. And I think that's why when we're looking at training, we need to look at a staircase of learning touch points along a pathway.
Some fabulous takeaways here from both of you around being eyes up, looking further down the road, driving to the conditions, and from Dinesh's perspective, what can happen potentially when you don't. Thank you very much, Russell. Congratulations on what you're doing with the Australian Road Safety Foundation and especially with Fatality Free Friday, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Rusty. Thanks, Lisa, and keep up the great work, guys.
On the next episode of Keep Your Wheels On,
we talk vehicle maintenance, which sounds really boring. But if you fail to keep your car roadworthy, it can lead to some really bad situations.
That caused the car to just veer off the road at 100 kilometres an hour.
And the very funny Shane Jacobson joins us. He is an avid vehicle collector and has driven everything from rattle traps to racing cars, sedans to semis, forklifts to Ferraris, Fords and Holdens, and everything in between.
If you have an EH Holden, it only has one red light, and that red light is everything's gone to shit light. That tells you too late, it's overheated, just thought I'd let you know.
I'm Rusty.
And I'm Lisa.
And this is Keep Your Wheels On. Keep Your Wheels On is a listener production brought to you in partnership with My Drive School, hosted by me, Greg Rust, and Lisa Scaife. Audio production by Kelly Fulston, and executive producer is Todd Stevens.
The Keep Your Wheels On podcast was funded by the Australian Government. Listener.